Welcome to Behind the Lore, your behind-the-scenes look into the research that it takes to make each episode of Lore Podcast. I'm Allie Steed, and today I'm sitting down with Jenna Rose Nethercott to discuss the research she did for episode 229, Dark Shapes. In this episode, Jenna Rose and I are exploring humans' innate pattern recognition, a new idea for a haunted house series, and our love for the great unknown. Your support keeps us going, so once again, we're thrilled to have you here with us. Welcome to a new episode of Behind the Lore. Clap. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Behind the Lore. I am here with Jenna Rose Nethercott, just catching her before she is off again on another leg of her tour.
Hello,
you're very
jet
setty these days. I'm kind of jealous.
Yeah, no, this is going to be a good one. The Nevada Humanities Council selected my novel Thistlefoot as the Nevada Reads book for like the season, and they're sending
That's
me
awesome.
On this amazing whirlwind tour of the whole state of Nevada, which is, I'm literally going to be doing two shows a day, which involve puppets, two puppet shows a day, all across Nevada. So if any of y'all, well, I guess by the time you hear this episode, wait, I'll still be in Nevada.
Yeah, it'll be next week.
If you're in Nevada and you want to see me and some puppets telling Baba Yaga folktales, you should look up the Nevada Humanities Council website. It's going to be a kooky time.
You get to go hang out in Nevada. I get to stay here for the cold. Everybody's doing their best this week.
You know, there's different levels of success depending on the moment of our lives.
That's true. I will count success if I do not horrendously have 8 sneezes in a row while we're recording this episode.
Ooh, I'd be impressed. I bet our listeners, maybe we can try and have a contest where the listeners, you know, it's like a drinking game. Every time Allie sneezes, you have to take a shot.
Oh, man.
That way we don't have to edit them out, you know?
You know what? That's true. That's true. We're making less work for Aaron in the long run.
That's right.
So, getting into everything, this episode felt very old school lore for me when I was reading through it. It's very classic monsters, spooky small town stuff. Had you heard any of these stories before you jumped into the research?
I had not. No, I'm not a big cryptids person, honestly. So I don't live near any of these regions, and so I hadn't heard the local lore of these 4 particular little beasties. So it was fun to discover some new weirdos out there.
Yeah, I feel like that's what happens a lot of times when we start doing the research for these. It's discovering a whole new world of weird.
That's great stuff
out there for us. It really is. One thing that jumped out at me about this episode specifically was there was a lot of lack of like sensory evidence, for lack of a better term. In another monster episode that you did that we talked about together, there were all these descriptions of the creatures. And the one thing that really lingered with me were the smells that were described in all of these reports. But they're not here. Like, what sources were you using for this episode? And why do you think they tended to lean so heavily on more visual evidence than anything else?
Yeah, so the other episode, which I kind of think of as like the sister episode to this episode, that one is like land weirdos, and this one is like lake weirdos. And I think that land weirdos, like, you can just smell things when they're on land in a way that you can't when they're in the water.
That's true.
So there was definitely more of like a scent element. Also, the land weirdos, part of the way, that's what I'm just going to call these episodes from now on.
Oh, yeah.
I forget what the actual name of that episode was, but it was the one with 4 different humanoid cryptids.
Mm-hmm.
And the, including like the big muddy monster, for example. And the,
yes.
One of the ways that those particular monsters were being tracked, was they were like leaving goop around. And so, you know, so there were more tangible sensory kind of residues to follow, where, you know, when you see something in the water, most water cryptids are just like a glimpse of like some strange little part of some creature, and then it vanishes back into the depths. So they're not touching them, they're not smelling them, they're not finding any traces of them after the fact. So it really is a visual experience. In terms of the sources, There's two sources that I feel like our listeners particularly would be interested in. I read a ton of, like, a whole bunch of articles about, you know, articles in newspapers and such that were kind of retelling these stories or taking oral reports. But the two sources I think for our listeners that would be really fun, one of them are the works of Lauren Coleman, who is a cryptozoologist that publishes just really thorough accounts of these sightings, where he, and I use the same source for the humanoids episode, he really just like compiles every oral report, every known sighting in a way that feels very, very thorough. And the other, which might be surprising, but is actually a very thorough source, is Cryptid Wiki, which
I don't think I've ever heard of Cryptid Wiki.
Yeah. So if you look up Cryptid Wiki, it's a website database of all the cryptids. And whoever works on compiling these is thorough as hell. Like, there are quotations from people who saw it. There's like dated lists of every time a creature was seen. And all the research that I've done, I found that these are actually very accurate compilations, and they often take directly from newspaper articles from the time reporting the events, and they don't really sensationalize it. So, yeah, Cryptid Wiki is actually surprisingly a very reliable resource when it comes to just looking up, like, what people claim to or believe they have seen and encountered.
Okay, well, I'm gonna go through and bookmark that when we're done here, because I feel like that's going to be an incredible source for lore or lore legends or lore bites at some point in the future.
Totally. Yeah, I've used it a lot whenever we're dealing with cryptozoology-based stuff. And I've fact-checked, you know, because you have to be careful with the wikis. They're user-edited. But I've repeatedly, I always fact-check anything I find on there with the original newspaper articles from the archives, and they match up with the original articles in the archives, which is really, it's a good resource.
Oh, yeah. We love a thorough researcher in this house.
That's what we're here for.
Oh, yeah. So we jump right in with the Stump Pond Serpent, not Serpent, which is how
Stump
I used
Pond
to say
Surfer.
It. I think that's a Scooby-Doo episode.
Yeah.
So Aaron starts us off, and you provide great research for this, with like this very bucolic, teeny little town, like, nice day, beautiful out, which could easily be the start of everything from a Little House on the Prairie episode to a horror movie. I feel like a lot of stories start out that way, and it gives us this real base sense of calm before we find all the weird stuff. And I really have to applaud Paquette and the two other miners for just not being the stereotypical victim we've seen in so many stories and just absolutely booking it out of there the first time they see something weird.
Oh, yeah. A little curiosity is always good for us down the line. Also, I really would like to see a crossover Little House on the Prairie horror reboot.
I think that's just like gothic something. I did find out that in doing research for something new for our listeners coming out very soon, that when the kind of Western frontier collapsed into economic and climate ruin, there were so many abandoned Victorian mansions that it inspired the haunted house genre. It created the haunted house genre.
Oh,
so we could get a Little House on the Prairie horror movie.
That's really interesting. I love that shit. That's cool.
Right?
Yeah.
So creepy.
Well, and now they're giving away all these empty lighthouses, so maybe we're going to see a resurgence of, like, haunted lighthouse stories.
That would be kind of fun.
Did y'all
see
this? That, like, they're giving lighthouses away willy-nilly because GPSs exist now?
Where do you have to go to get a free lighthouse? Like, do I have to
move
very far for that?
If any of our listeners has power over free lighthouses, please give us a DM. And by give us a DM, I mean give us a lighthouse. Can you imagine how atmospheric this podcast would be if we were doing it inside a lighthouse? You know, this
would be
for
very
you.
On brand for us.
This isn't you know, none of this is selfish. It's all for you.
And definitely not because you have a dream of wearing chunky sweaters every day and living out in the middle of nowhere overlooking the Barents Sea.
No, I definitely don't want to drink lighter fluid with Willem Dafoe.
Well, we all have a dream, something to strive for one of these days.
Anyway.
We were talking about monsters, and we went everywhere from Little House on the Prairie to lighthouses.
Yes.
So kind of getting back into it, why do you think there was such a large gap between the 1800s sighting and the one in the 1960s?
I mean, okay, so assuming that people were actually seeing something and not that it was just legendary, assuming that there was something in the water, I just assumed that they were two different, completely unrelated creatures. Mm-hmm. But because there was folklore in the region, the consciousness of the people kind of merged them into one, because they were like, oh, we've heard folktales about something in the water. Someone saw something new in the water. It must be related to the last thing we saw in the water.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if you see something, you already know something is there, then you're just going to assume it's that thing.
Yeah. And our brains as humans, we're wired to see patterns and to make connections. So, yeah, I think that's probably what's going on here.
Yeah. So why was the pond drained? Because in 1968, you noted that the pond was drained, and I just need to know, was there an actual practical reason for that, or was somebody looking for the monster? Like, how do you justify that to the city council getting up at a town hall meeting being like, listen, I know this is going to cost a lot of money and a lot of man hours, but I need to know what's out there. And they didn't find what they were looking for, but that catfish, man, that was way too big to be normal.
Yeah, so I think it's very funny how in the episode there was a heavy implication that it was drained for the monster. I saw nothing in my research to say it was drained for the monster. I didn't put anything in my research that said it was drained for the monster. But it is, my guess is they probably drained it, you know, to create more usable land or because there was some sort of erosion issue. You know, I don't know. I didn't find a specific explanation as to why it was drained. But, you know, ponds and lakes get drained sometimes for practical reasons that don't involve monsters. But, you know, because I didn't find an explanation, who knows? Maybe they were like, let's get that monster.
I mean, there could have been a reason under the reason that it was, in fact, to see what was down there, like, just in case.
Just a little curiosity.
And they find a big old catfish, like a freaking huge catfish.
It's true. What was 30 it, pounds. 30 pounds? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big
That's
boy.
That's too many. That's too many pounds. I don't like that. Like, okay, do you think there was anything in the pond besides overly large catfish? I feel like this could be solved by some good old-fashioned noodling, but you had a couple options in your research that lean a little more into the human connection than the supernatural.
Yeah, so people in this area were used to hearing these monster stories, right? And, you know, like I said a moment ago, our brains are hardwired to make patterns and to tell stories. So there's this illusory correlation that developed in the region where people would just, if they heard about a sound in the lake, they would immediately assume, oh, this must be some kind of sea creature or not sea creature, lake creature, pond creature, when maybe there wasn't any. So that's one explanation is just, you know, when we're used to hearing stories, we want to slot things into the stories that we know and understand, even if the stories we understand are a lack of understanding, right? But then, you know, who knows? Maybe there's something in the area or the landscape that tends to provide a perfect habitat for anomalous creatures or large creatures in some way. When it comes to cryptids, I really don't lean into the supernatural. I always kind of assume that there's just some kind of actual animal that's being seen that's probably being hyperbolized by whoever sees them because they're freaked out. You know, we always hear these descriptions of somebody seeing something that is later described to be an owl or discovered to be a person, and they're like, no, it was 8 feet tall with glowing red eyes. And it's like fear can make people see and hyperbolize a lot. But yeah, so I think that there's a number of explanations as to what was in there, and my guess is it was some combination of big fish and human fear.
That's fair. I am also afraid of big fish. So I
as
I can't
well
say I
you
blame
should
them.
Be, Allie.
So we slide from Illinois all the way up to Alaska, and Aaron brings up a really interesting point in this episode about seeing being believing. Was there ever something in your extensive travels that you just couldn't believe you were actually seeing? Like, I kind of wish we were recording this after your next tour, because that clown motel you were telling me about just seems way too wild to be real.
Oh, I'm so excited. I get to stay in the clown motel. Okay, so basically this this tour I'm going on, for context for the listeners, the Nevada Humanities Council, they're putting me up in hotels all over Nevada. And so I was like, hey, do I get to request, can I request which hotels I want? And they were like, yeah, sure, I guess. And I was like, okay, well, you're having me stay in Tonopah, and I just so happen to know that the Clown Motel is in Tonopah. Now, the Clown Motel is like a seedy truck stop motel that is scary clown themed.
Yeah, where this is my version of hell, by the way.
Every room has like paintings of like horrifying clowns in them.
Oh,
and
God.
So I was like, put me in the clown hotel, put me in the clown hotel. And the Humanities Council, bless them for indulging me. We're like, okay, I guess we're going to put this psycho in the clown hotel with like state money. So I'll absolutely report back about that. But to answer your original question.
I do hope we hear from you again after you stay in that hotel.
There's no promises being made here. But yeah, I've seen... Okay, so there's this one particular story that I won't tell the whole thing because it takes like 10 minutes to tell. But I will say, if you want to hear the whole story after this little sampler, I wrote the whole thing out in an essay for LitHub that was published on Halloween of last year. So if you Google my name, Jenna Rose Nethercott, with LitHub, you'll find an essay on ghosts, and that tells this whole story. But... Okay, so when I was traveling on tour with my last book, The Lumberjack's Dove, which is a book-length poem in the form of a folktale, I was driving across the country, living out of the trunk of my Honda Fit, and I found myself in Alabama. And this one night, it was pouring rain, and I was going to just sleep in the trunk of my car. I had just finished a reading at a local bookstore, and the bookseller was like, hey, where are you staying tonight? And, you know, so I was honest with her. I was like, yeah, I'm just going to crash in my car. And she goes, oh, no, I have room in my house. You should come stay in one of my spare rooms. And I was like, oh, that's very gracious. Thank you. And so I follow her car headlights through the rain, and she turns off onto this drive. There's like two carved stone lions on either side
Jenna
of the drive.
Rose, you are killing me right now.
And there's like Spanish moss tunnels that we're like driving down this windy path. And as we finally arrive, I see looming in the distance of the dark what I can only describe as looking like the Wikipedia photo for haunted house.
Oh God.
And before we had left, she was like, look, before we get to my house, I just want to say, like, my home is a bit of a, well, let's just say it's an experiment in southern decay. And I was like, don't know what that means. Can't wait to find out. So we get to this house. It is a sprawling, sprawling gothic southern manor. There are like balustrades like lining the house, all these columns and pillars. Its paint is peeling. It's in disrepair. It's huge. And I'm like, Jesus, like, how many people live here? And she goes, oh, it's just me. And I say,
Jenna Rose, this is every horror novel I ever read in junior high.
And I say, oh, how did you acquire this property, ma'am?
Dead grandma?
Well, she says, well, it belonged to my aunt, and then my other aunt, and then my great aunt, and then her sister, and now me. It's
there
been in our family for 99 years.
There we go.
And so she leads me through the double doors. And, well, you're going to have to look up the essay for the rest of it, because I don't have time to tell this whole story. But suffice to say, it only gets weirder and weirder and weirder from there. But that's just my little teaser of my night. So yeah, look up Jenna Rose Nethercott, LitHub, and the ghost essay. It's also, if you follow my Instagram, actually, it's like the pinned little box it's right on my Instagram. Yeah, underscore perfect. Jenna Rose with a G, underscore. And I'm not trying to, I swear I'm not trying to like rep myself here. I just think this is a crazy story and it's worth reading in its entirety.
I'm definitely going to read it, if only so that I can just absolutely roast you for when the moment comes that you do end up in a horror movie of some kind.
I really do. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as I saw that house, I was like, oh, I'm in that story.
Yeah,
like,
you are.
I'm the like lost traveler who just is like seeking some warmth from the rain, who ends up being like eaten by vampires. Regrets. 10 out of 10 would do again.
Well, you made it out, so.
I sure did.
Well, I have no way to gracefully transition back to Lake Monster, so we're just going to jump into my next question. It's interesting to me that the Jigignac, apologies for pronunciation, sighting in 1942 wasn't just one creature, but several, like in a pod of some kind, which isn't something that I'd heard before. Maybe ones and twos, but that's about it. Like,
yeah, we don't usually see like group cryptid sightings. And it is actually strange given what, at least my belief in what these creatures probably were like one of two options. Either it was a sturgeon, which are solitary creatures.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really make sense they'd be moving in like a school. But those are the ones that certainly fit the description most accurately. Also, as we mentioned in the episode, sturgeons are more deep sea. They don't surface that often. So there would have had to be something really weird going on with these sturgeon for them to be moving on the surface in a group. The other possibility was beluga whales, who are social, but they really don't visibly match the descriptions at all. As well as the strange detail that beluga whales were very common in this area, and locals knew what a beluga whale looked
right.
like. And they were all like, whatever this was, this is not a beluga whale. We know
it's
a beluga whale.
It's just weird.
So yeah. there is something very strange to me about the fact that it was that there were groups, just because it doesn't actually fit the species descriptions of what we understand these to probably or possibly be.
Yeah, it's so bizarre that... I mean, there's water distortion and all of this stuff, but like the native creatures that we know are there don't match. And even if you're being generous with like blurry Nessie photograph energy, like something just didn't up here.
Yeah, it's who knows. I mean, you know, there are times when animals behave in an unexpected or analogous analogous. Nope, that's not the. They behave weird. I tried.
You did try.
It's early in the morning for me, by which I mean it's 11:34 a.m.
But I feel so bad every time I message you for these at like 9 in the morning, and you're like,
"Well, I just don't see that.
Can we do it later?"
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a night owl, but Yeah, anyway, so, you know, there are instances where animals, there's some sort of disturbance in their habitat and they behave in strange, unexpected ways, which it could be that sort of situation.
Totally. Has anyone ever tried to take the Anchorage Daily News up on their reward offer?
I don't think they have. So in 1979, the Anchorage Daily News, they offered $100,000 to anyone who could prove, like, they could provide solid evidence for the creature's existence. But no solid evidence ever came. So, yeah, so no one's ever been able to collect the $100,000. Huh. I mean, the Animal Planet show, quote, River Monsters, did try to find out was in the lake, but no one found anything. So
no one found anything?
No.
Well, if it was just something natural that looked weird that couple of times, then I don't know.
But hey, you know, maybe I don't know if the Anchorage Daily News is still an institution, but if you find any of that evidence, maybe they'll still give you that 100 grand.
Yeah, right. We could hook you up. You don't know. It's so interesting to me as we move on to the Flathead Lake Monster that the descriptions are wildly different. Like, I know the water blurs some things, but the first story we have, the very first description, which to me reads as more mythological than anything, there was an antler. where did the antler go? The antler is in none of the other stories, and it doesn't sound like the kids got close enough to actually cutting it off that it was gone.
Yeah, so again, I think this is one of those instances of two different encounters that have become conflated with each other because of geography and folklore. The first sighting with the antlers were, in my opinion, likely allegorical. So I'm no Kootenai Indian, so I am not the one to speak on this legend, and I can't say for sure what the Kootenai, whether they viewed this as allegorical or literal. But as a folklorist, this story resembles the kind of explanatory stories that we see worldwide. So, you know, an explanation for why there were so few Kootenai Indians, because that was kind of the moral of the story that was told, is after they would tell this tale of these girls approaching this antler in the ice and pulling on it, and this beast coming out of the water and then breaking the ice and sinking so many of the people, it was a way for then people to say, and yes, and that is why there are so few of us today. Kind of an allegory to explain something real. And, you know, it makes me wonder, too, what may have actually happened to reduce that population. As we know, folklore is often used as kind of a shield for a more painful truth.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's possible that there was something more horrific that had caused this population to shrink. It's also possible that there was a very similar experience where, you know, maybe there was a creature in the ice. You know, it could be anything. Maybe the ice just cracked and people fell through, and then this folklore surrounded it, and, you know, a monster was added to that story. Also, you know, I've been watching a lot of Yellow Jackets lately, so maybe that's what's giving me this idea. But, like, there could have been a moose frozen in the ice, you know, with an antler sticking through. Or any, you know, there's all sorts of creatures that might have frozen in a body of water with an antler sticking out that then could have caused the ice to crack. Like, literally, that's a scene in Yellow Jackets where there's a moose frozen in the ice. They try to pull it out, and then they end up having to run off the ice because it's going to crack, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. But yeah, who knows? And then my guess is whatever was seen later was probably just something different that got associated.
As with our first legend back in Illinois.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, that's probably the case for a number of these creatures throughout, like, I mean, especially when they're seen across centuries, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting to me, the Flathead Monster, especially because compared to our other stories in this episode, there are a lot of recorded sightings, more than I would expect, and some way more modern. Mm-hmm. Than I would have thought. 1993, 2005, comes all the way up through. Like, I don't think this is some kind of narwhal situation, because that would be wildly out of place, but would certainly make things interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and I think when you see sightings like that, there's probably some kind of big guy down there.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, is it magic? Probably not. But whatever it is freaking people out.
Yeah. I do appreciate that we kind of end this episode talking about, you know, the Flathead Monster saving a kid when they fall into the water, which I think was very sweet. I hope her and her baby are just out there vibing somewhere in the lake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we love a kid monster friendship.
Yeah.
It has a real, like, early 90s movie.
Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah, Free Willy kind of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No? And you know, not all monsters are there to hurt you. Some monsters are there to save your kids.
Not all monsters.
Not all, hashtag not all monsters.
Well, this was a pretty cool episode to read through. It was pretty interesting, and I especially like your takes as a folklorist going through all of these stories and seeing how much is human nature and how much of it is just maybe funky, weird fish.
Yeah, and you know, the truth is with these, and one of the things that I think is so fun about stories like this, is that we just don't know, and we're never going to know. Mm-hmm. So it's all speculation. All of my reflections on it are speculation. But it's pretty fun to speculate.
It is really fun to speculate. That's why we have a job. It's fun to speculate.
That is exactly why
you
we have a job.
You all enjoy it.
You're gonna enjoy it.
I meant that to be way less threatening, but, you know, whatever it takes.
Well, thanks, y'all, for tuning in again.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. We will see you next time.
Beautiful.
And that does it for today's episode of Behind the Lore. Many thanks to Jenna Rose for chatting with me today. A lot of folks don't know this, but Lore is actually part of a larger network of shows called Grim and Mild, and you can learn more about those shows and everything else going on over at one central place, grimandmild.com. On behalf of the entire Lore team, thank you for your constant and generous support, and for letting us tell you our stories. And until next time, thanks for listening.